Farmers markets have brought a lot of us closer to the people who grow some of our food, but there's still a big disconnect between those of us who live in town and the farmers who work the land. Today, we'll talk about ways we can cross that divide. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day. This hour, Linda Nave, Iowa State University Extension Program Specialist in Value-Added Agriculture, will be here. We'll talk about some of the ways you can visit farms, including farm crawls and U-pick operations. Iowa State University Extension horticulturist Richard Giron will also be here. We'll talk about how high tunnels saved a lot of producers from a cool, wet spring and the damage the heavy rainfall in the last couple of weeks has done in gardens. Join our conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day today. Iowa State University Extension horticulturist Richard Giron will join us in a few minutes to answer your questions. But we're going to start the hour with a conversation about how you can get closer to the people who grow the food that you eat. Linda Nave is here, Iowa State University Extension Program Specialist for Extension's Value-Added Agriculture Program. Hello, Linda. Thank you so much for being here today. We seem to be having a hard time hearing you.
Really?
Now we're good.
Okay.
All right.
Okay,
wonderful.
There we go.
All right. Linda, farmers markets have become more and more popular over the last couple of decades, particularly in the last decade, and that has introduced a lot of us to some of the farmers who grow our food. Why do you think that's valuable?
Well, people are connecting more with the food that they eat. They want to see, they want to know, they want to talk to the farmers. I think it's a cultural thing. I think it's a health thing issue. It's just become, I shouldn't say a trend, but it's become very popular. And in that end, there's more and more interest in farmers markets. There's more interest in going to the grocery store and finding the locally grown produce. Restaurants are advertising in their menu and in their advertisements that they buy from local vendors. Buy Fresh, Buy Local is an organization, a nonprofit organization that connects people with businesses, with farmers markets, with CSAs, to bring in the local flavor, so to speak.
What do you think the people who are buying that food, beyond getting fresh food that they like the taste of, what do you think we get out of actually seeing farmers and getting to know them, talking to them face to face?
We get a better understanding of how that produce is grown. And with our culture the way we are today and more urban than rural, we are finding people are disconnected with where their food comes from, particularly young people. Don't really fully understand how a broccoli plant grows, that a carrot comes from the ground, that milk comes from a cow, chickens come from eggs, or eggs come from chickens. I'm getting mixed up here. And this sort of thing, it's very important that we understand where our food comes from, particularly in Iowa, where farming is such a big part of our economy and part of our lifestyle.
Now, as I mentioned, farmers markets have gotten to be more popular, and a lot of us are getting to know farmers that way. But now there are getting to be more other ways we can get to know farmers and actually bridge that divide between city and farm even more completely by visiting farms. What are some of the new ways that we can get out and see farms?
Well, with the internet today, we can find Iowa farms, and some Iowa farms do open up their production, their facility for visitors. And there is a website, and this website is called Visit Iowa Farms. And the Visit Iowa Farms program is administered by the Extension Value-Added Agriculture Program at Iowa State University, where I work. And the program provides unbiased, research-based information to help establish and expand agriculture-related businesses, such as the agritourism industry that's growing in Iowa. The Visit Iowa Farms is a place where farms can be listed as agritourism farms, and so you can find a particular farmer. Let's say you're looking for pumpkins. You're looking for pumpkins to purchase. You're looking for a pumpkin farm to visit. You're looking for a location that has a corn maze or has a pumpkin patch associated with it or a berry patch to pick berries. All of these things are listed on the Visit Iowa Farms .org website. Just simple as that. Visit iowafarms.org. There's a calendar of events to see what's coming up in the state related to visiting Iowa farms, some related news articles. You can go find wineries, lots of places you can go around Iowa, not just in a specific location within Iowa, to find a farm to visit. It's a great outing for a family, a weekend activity, a morning activity to take your children out to see the farm.
And that website is visitiowafarms.org. Then also there are people who are putting on farm crawls. What is a farm crawl?
A farm crawl is you don't have to get down on your hands and knees and move across the farm. What it is there are a number of farms on one particular day or weekend that have open houses and they have a map. It's kind of like a realtor open houses, a realtor show of homes. It's a farm crawl. And you go from one farm to the other and they will showcase what they sell, what they produce. There will be activities for children. It could be a petting zoo. It could be a pick your own. It could be a processing jams and jellies and purchase that is produced right there on the farm. And there are a number of these situated throughout the state this year. The concept is growing. Local foods, regional food systems working groups are sponsoring these in various areas, as are Buy Fresh, Buy Local organizations. So it's a great way that you can visit one or eight farms in a given area. And you can do this all in one day. Some are even furnishing locally grown meals that you can purchase at noon or a big special dinner at night. So there are lots of activities going on with these farm crawls.
Now, I can imagine if I were a farmer, obviously farming is extremely difficult work, that having a lot of people come to my farm would be kind of stressful. I would have to get the farm ready and make sure that things were cleaned up and looked good, which isn't always the number one priority of a farmer. What is in it for the farmer?
Well, it showcases what they have to offer. So if you're looking for a particular item or you want to know where they will be vending at local farmers markets, you get to see actually where they are. Farmers market vendors will have people say, well, I'd really like to come and see your farm. Well, they can't have visitors coming every day of the week. That's not convenient for them, or they don't have time. But by having an open house, everyone who's interested can come and see their farm at one time.
All right. And there are a number of these scheduled throughout the summer. The first one is on the 4th of July coming up, the Fairfield Farm Crawl. And as you mentioned, that's eight area farms. So there are a lot of farms who are getting in on this.
That's right. There are a lot of farms there. There's the Fairfield Farm Crawl on July 4th. On July 20th, which is a Saturday, they call it the J40 Farm Crawl, and it follows a route around Keosauqua. The annual J4 Farm Crawl includes a dozen farms and businesses along the Des Moines River Valley, beginning in Keosauqua and heading west. They've got all kinds of things planned, wine tasting, local artists, clay oven baking, so it's not just produce, it's other things that are related to farming along the way. And that's on July 20th. Farm Crawl 2013 is in South Central Iowa, and it's on Sunday, October 6th, in the 11 to 5 p.m. The Northeast Iowa Farm Crawl is September 9th. And then the, as I mentioned before, the J40 Farm Crawl. And so there's just a lot of them wherever you live that you can find open houses at the farms.
Is this an area, I mean, you work in value-added agriculture. This is part of that program. Is this a real area of growth for farmers in Iowa?
Yes, it's an area of growth to have agritourism. And agritourism is growing because people do want to see where their farm is, where their food is grown. They use it as an opportunity for recreation and orchards, berry patches, pumpkin patches, farms that have farm mazes. It's another source of revenue for the farmers.
Now, you probably hear anecdotal stories from farmers who are participating in these programs. Do you know, are there people coming from out of state or even out of the country who participate in this?
Charity, that I can't give you any statistics on, but I'm sure that there are. visitors to Iowa, and you take your company or your visitors to Iowa out to a local farm. So I'm sure all that is happening, although I don't have the statistics on that.
All right, and we've put up a link to visitiowafarms.org where you can find out information about farms that you can visit in your area. I want to turn the conversation. This has been such a strange year in so many ways, Linda. Of course, I think every year in Iowa is different and strange. But with our wet, cool spring, I know another area that you do a lot of work on is high tunnel production, those hoop houses or covered tunnels that we see on more and more farms around Iowa. And those have been really important this year. Why is that?
They have been extremely important, particularly to the commercial vegetable and fruit producers who are vending at farmers markets. As if you have your own home garden, you're realizing that, oh my gosh, everything is late. We had snow in early May. Even if you had onions and potatoes and cabbage in the garden, they didn't grow. So they are falling behind. Tomato plants perhaps weren't planted the exact time that you wanted them to be planted due to the weather, so they are very slow in getting established. So then you go to the farmer's market and you see a vendor who might have green beans already, or tomatoes, or cucumbers, and you're thinking to yourself, how can this grower possibly have all these things that require warm temperatures? Well, what they're doing is they're growing them in high tunnels. And the number of high tunnels throughout the state has significantly increased because of the advantages that they offer commercial vegetable growers.
There's also been a lot of support for high tunnel growers, right?
There has. There's a program through the NRCS offices. It's called through the Know Your Farmer, Know Your Food program, in which they are supporting and cost sharing the cost of producing, putting up a high tunnel for fruit and vegetable growers. There's certain qualifications that the fruit and vegetable growers need to meet in order to qualify for this assistance. But what it does is it helps sustain natural resources because there's little runoff. The inputs are minimal coming off of a high tunnel. It's an excellent way to produce quality, low input fruits and vegetables early in the season and late in the season. So over the last 3 to 4 years, a good educated guess would be there have been an additional 300 high tunnels put up throughout the state for commercial vegetable production.
Do you see that as an area that's also going to grow a lot in coming years?
I think so, and I don't know as so much the number of farmers, new farmers putting up high tunnels, as the number of farmers with existing high tunnels realizing the profit potential from a high tunnel, adding to their high tunnel. So instead of one, they maybe add another one or the third high tunnel as production increases.
So this could be something that really will change our landscape in coming years.
It will, and it's caught on big in Europe. There are multiple high tunnel farms over there. Again, we can produce a high quality product with less risk with heavy rains flooding us out, hail, heavy winds. These kind of things can affect your crop if you have them in the field. Where in a high tunnel in a more protected environment, we can manage that.
All right. We're going to take a short break. We'll get back to taking your calls, your questions about your yard or garden at 866-780-9100. Linda Nave, Iowa State University Extension, is with us. Richard Giron will be joining us in a moment. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day today, and you are welcome to join the conversation with your questions about your yard, your garden, your trees. Give us a call at 866-780-9100, 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Linda Nave, Iowa State University Extension Program Specialist for Extension's Value-Added Agriculture Program, is here. And Richard Giron is here as well from Iowa State University Extension. Hello, Richard.
Good morning.
Thank you for being here. And let's talk about this rainfall we've had in the last couple of weeks. We've had some really powerful storms go through and a lot of heavy rainfall. What kinds of changes have you seen going on in gardens because of that, Richard?
Well, basically everything is behind quite a bit. So we're not going to see much as far as vegetable production in the home garden until maybe mid to late August, possibly, on things like tomatoes, squash, cucumbers. Everything is basically just behind. It's been too wet.
What about strawberries? Because this heavy rain came right in the middle of a lot of strawberry crops. And did that pulverize the strawberries that were out there?
I don't think it did, but there may have been more rotting because you had this damp ground. And if you have a berry resting on a damp surface, you tend to get more fruit rot. So there was probably more rotting of some of the fruit.
Is there anything that has done particularly well so far this year? Is there a silver lining here somewhere?
Grass.
Weeds.
Grass
sure.
And weeds.
Mm-hmm. We're having an amazing cherry crop on our property, mm-hmm. which is that we had a crop in 2010 and then no crop in 2011, no crop in 2012. So we're having a lot of fun with that. And the cherries are very good. But also, and I'm a country girl, so I love to eat mulberries. The mulberries taste awful this year.
Well, probably just too darn wet, cloudy, cold, too wet. And that's when you have those conditions, sometimes you don't have sugars develop like they normally do in your fruit. It's mainly just water. And so you don't really have that good taste.
Yeah, well, they're not worth your time. I wonder if birds and raccoons are even bothering this year. They're that bad. Hmm. You can join our conversation at 866-780-9100. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And Paul is on the line from Bettendorf. Hi, Paul.
Hi.
Hi.
I have a question about my lawn, how high to cut the grass. I'd always heard, like, not more than one-third, but someone told me to cut it real short.
Well, basically, in the summer, we suggest a cutting height of around 3 inches. And so you want to mow the yard when the grass is maybe 4, 4.5 inches tall. But I'd be cutting it off at a height of 3 inches in the summer. And in the fall, you can reduce it a little bit, maybe go down to 2.5 inches. Also in the spring, around 2.5 inches, but a little higher in the summertime, when the weather is more stressful.
Okay. Well, that's what I thought. I just didn't think too short would be a good thing.
No, not in the summertime. That's not a good thing, no.
Okay. And my cherries and raspberries are doing great this year.
Oh, good. That's good to hear.
All right. Thank you.
Yep. Thanks a lot for your call, Paul. You can join the conversation at 866-780-9100. 866-780-9100. You can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. You can tweet us at IPRTalk, or you can post on our Facebook page. Look for us at Iowa Public Radio. And we do have lines open for your call right now, so it's a good time to get in. 866-780-9100. And Richard, you say grass has been doing really well this year, and it's been growing really rapidly. But are we, some of us, who get behind causing problems because we are cutting grass that has already gone to seed or is really tall?
Well, if you let it get too tall, let's say it gets 5, 6 inches tall, and then you mow it down to like 2, 2.5 inches, you're taking off so much of the leaf tissue at any one time that is very stressful. And so that's not a good thing. If you do that and you do that repeatedly, the grass is under stress. And then the weeds, which are just lurking around, take that opportunity to establish themselves. And then you have a weed problem.
All right. So if your grass goes to seed, if you just can't keep up with it, is there something special you should do when you cut it?
Well, if it gets tall, then you want to go out there as soon as you can and mow it as high as you can. And if you have a lot of debris, then I would rake it off or bag it. Just because you have so much debris, you don't want that debris sitting on top of the grass. So if you have a lot of debris, either bag it or rake it off.
All right. So it's basically do exactly what is the opposite of your instinct to do.
Right.
Okay. All right. Linda is on the line next from Des Moines. Hi, Linda.
Good morning.
Hi. What's your question?
Once I've cut down the invasive honeysuckle and spritzed it with Roundup, what can I put in about a 100 by 20-foot area so that the invasive honeysuckle doesn't come back with vengeance?
Well, I think they will come back to some extent. They just, the birds love the fruit. And they distribute the seeds very, very efficiently. If it's a shady area, I would try to establish some native plant materials, plants that we would typically see in shady areas.
For example?
Everything, for example, as far as perennials, things like woodland phlox, wild columbine, wild ginger, Solomon seal, those type of things. And then maybe some woody plants, too, that we would typically find in the woods, like maybe gray dogwood and that type of thing.
Perfect. Thank you very much.
All right, Linda, thanks for your call. And Richard, how long do you have to wait after, if she clears that out, and as she mentioned, spraying it with Roundup, how long do you have to wait before you would plant something?
Actually, it's not very long at all. Roundup basically is held very tightly by the soil particles, so usually you can come back within like a week or two and plant.
All right. Glenn in Alamon is on the line next. Hi, Glenn.
Hi.
Hi, what's your question?
Well, I was I've been wondering about being able to grow huckleberries in Iowa.
Not very feasible or practical, I would say. It's not impossible, but it's not very practical. Those are typically more associated with climates like Maine, Pacific Northwest, and Iowa is typically just not a very suitable environment.
Yeah, when we were in the Pacific Northwest last year, there seemed like there was huckleberry ice cream and huckleberry this and huckleberry that, and it was delicious. So
right.
Huckleberries are similar to blueberries, right?
Correct. They are.
Can you describe how they taste different, Glenn?
Well, they're I would call them lighter and sweeter than maybe not sweeter than blueberries, but a little bit lighter and pretty sweet. Similar to blueberries in taste.
All right.
Now, one thing you might want to try, and right now they're ripening, is the actual serviceberry, which is an ornamental plant.
Yeah.
It's a large shrub, small tree. They're ripening right now. My tree has quite a few fruit. They're actually very, very tasty. They're very good.
If you can beat the birds to them.
Yes, but they are very, very good, and we can grow that plant very easily. So you might consider that as a possibility. And we also have the blueberries, which we can grow too. But the service berries are ripening right now, and they're very, very good.
And service berries are very winter hardy?
Yes, absolutely. We can grow those no problem at all. They're ornamental. They have the white flowers in the spring. They have the nice fall foliage, where the foliage might be yellow to orange to red. And then you have the fruit, which ripen basically in June. And this year, the plants are just loaded with fruit.
And you don't need male and female?
Nope, you don't. Nope.
Would that be
okay? Well, thanks a lot.
Yeah, thanks for your call, Glenn.
The information,
Richard. Would that be a good one for the shade? The person who called in previous to put in her shady area.
The serviceberry, basically in its native habitat, typically is kind of found in partial shade. Maybe at the edge of a woods where it might get a few hours of sun, so it's not full shade, but maybe partial shade.
And Richard, what do you use your serviceberries for?
I just pick them off and eat them.
All right.
Simple.
Do people make pies? Is there a...
Oh, sure. Sure, they make pies. They'll use them in muffins. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Just like blueberries, basically.
All right. It's Horticulture Day on Talk of Iowa with me, Richard Giron and Linda Nave from Iowa State University Extension. They are here to answer your questions at 866-780-9100. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Bonnie is on the line from Moline. Hi, Bonnie.
Hi, Charity. I have such great news. I have a mulberry tree also, and it's the best crop I've had in years, and they're sweet and delicious.
Wonderful. Well, you must have had perfect weather for it, and we didn't have it at all.
And I think my brother and his wife said because we had a late spring, because they have roses that are just growing like, 4 feet tall, and they're just all over the place. They're absolutely gorgeous. And she said that's from the late spring as well.
Well, interesting. All right, Bonnie, thanks a lot for your call.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Jeanette is on the line next from Iowa City. Hi, Jeanette.
Hi. We have a real nice sour cherry tree, and it's very prolific. And this year, all of the ripe cherries are split, and I wondered what caused that.
We're having a problem with that at our house, too. Not all of them, but a lot of them are split. Richard?
I'm thinking maybe this happened after a heavy rain, where you had a heavy rain and you had the tree absorb large quantities of moisture. That moisture moved up into the fruit, and it couldn't expand fast enough, and it just cracks.
Oh.
And so you can get that on things like fruits, like even melons will sometimes crack, where tomatoes will crack, where you have this rapid water uptake, and then there's just too much water, and the thing cracks.
Mm-hmm.
So,
and but it's okay to use the cherries.
Yeah, they're not very attractive, but they're still usable.
And you have to use them right away, so no.
Okay. And could I ask? We also had planted a sweet cherry tree, and the only thing that's growing now this year is the foliage below the graft, and so it looks like we're not going to have a cherry tree. Is that right?
Right, you've lost it basically because the rootstock is a different plant. It's not going to give you what you really want.
Okay, thank you very much.
All right, Jeanette, thanks for your call. And can we grow sweet cherries in Iowa?
Yes, we can. We can't grow very many. There are about two or three new varieties introduced by Cornell University in New York, which are much hardier than some of the older varieties. And we can probably grow these in the southern, maybe two-thirds of Iowa, so basically south of Highway 20. And these would be things like gold, white gold, and I think black gold. And they're basically sweet cherries, and they are quite hardy. And I think two or three of those are self-fruitful. So.
Oh, great. I'm writing this down, Richard.
So gold, white gold, and black gold.
All right, terrifically. And cherry trees are pretty finicky, aren't they?
Well, they are in that they need a well-drained soil. They just do not like a wet site. And so if you put them in a poorly drained area, and then you have a wet year like this year, they can definitely develop some root problems. And I would say their lifespan will be shortened appreciably. So they really do insist on that well-drained soil. Beyond that, they're okay, but it has to be well-drained.
All right. So let's go back to the phones. Bruce is on the line. Hi, Bruce.
Oh, hello. I hate to jinx anything, but I'm just wondering if we're going to have an invasion of the Japanese beetles this year. I've had some plants that are actually thriving so far.
I would assume so. They're probably going to be showing up maybe in a week or two, is my guess. So, no, the rain did not drown them, unfortunately. So,
okay. So is soapy water with in a peanut butter jar still the best way to deal with them? Or,
that's one way of doing it, where you go out early in the morning when they're very lethargic, and you can just knock them off into soapy water. You can also use the more traditional insecticides if you wish. But they'll be around, I'm sure,
okay.
Unfortunately.
Well, I was hoping to beat them. Incidentally, the Juneberries, they're really quite good this year. I don't know if you guys get them quite in your area or not, but that's another thing that people might want to put in their yards.
Juneberry is the serviceberry, which is the Saskatoon, which is the Amelanchier.
Yeah, it goes by several names.
Yes.
Shad bush is another term for it. It has multiple common names, but yeah, the fruit are great this year. They really are.
All right. And I think, Bruce, thanks a lot for your call. I think Nikki in Cedar Falls may have a question related to this as well. Hi, Nikki.
Hi. I'm calling. I grew up in southwestern Iowa, and we had a berry plant that everybody called it a sodas berry. And it looked like a raspberry, but it was bigger and plumper and lighter in color. And I have been trying to track down whatever that berry is since I moved away, and I was wondering if you could help me.
That name sounds somewhat familiar. I'm thinking that may be a variety of some type of bramble, but I don't know exactly which one it would be. There are many, many varieties of your blackberries, of your raspberries, and I think it's one of those, but I don't know exactly which one it is.
Okay.
So you might want to just, if you have your computer, type in Rubus, R-U-B-U-S, which is the genus name, and then Sodus, and see if that brings up anything.
And how would you spell Sodus?
Like soda with an S, S-O-D-A-S.
Right. S-O-D-U-S is how I would spell it.
All right.
All right. Good luck with that.
Okay,
I was hoping that was going to be an easy serviceberry question.
No, no.
sadly, no.
That's a good response, though.
All right. Amanda's on the line next in Pleasantville. Hi, Amanda.
Hi.
Hi. What's your question?
I was wondering if you could suggest a shrub, preferably a native shrub, to put under a big fir tree that's been, like, the branches are trimmed up about 6 or 8 feet.
Hmm. Okay, and how big would you like it to be?
Well, I was thinking on the order of, 5 to 6 feet tall.
Okay. There are some plants that are native to Iowa, maybe not in your region, but I'm thinking maybe something like a gray dogwood, which is not commonly sold, but it's out there. So gray dogwood, and that will get to be maybe 6-7 feet tall or so.
And what about azaleas? Do they do okay in Iowa, or is it not the right climate?
Yeah, they're not native to begin with. They're not.
Okay.
And the actual azaleas would like at least 6 hours of direct sun. And so if it's shady, it's not really a good site for them. You do have rhododendrons, which retain their leaves in fall. And they're a little more shade tolerant, but they still need maybe 3-4 hours of direct sun.
Okay.
I'm thinking maybe like the gray dogwood. Also, there's one called the bush honeysuckle, which is not a true honeysuckle. It just goes by that common name, and it's actually native to northeast Iowa. It grows about maybe 2-3 feet tall.
All right, Amanda, I hope you got some good ideas. We're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment with Richard Geron and Linda Nave from Iowa State University Extension. You can join the conversation with your questions at 866-780-9100 or send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day today. With me, Linda Nave, Iowa State University Extension Program Specialist for Extension's Value-Added Agriculture Program, Richard Geron, Iowa State University Extension Horticulturist, and we are happy to answer your questions as well. 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk or send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Linda, this one's for you from Larry in Elkader. He says, it's great to get early and late produce using high tunnels, but doesn't the use of high tunnels substantially increase labor by requiring irrigation? Is there any way to streamline the watering?
Larry, you got a great point there. It does require, the high tunnel creates a desert environment because it's like having an umbrella over the soil. So you do have to supplement, you do have to add all the water in that environment. However, there are ways we can... Growers are getting around that. They're using a drip irrigation system. They're not going out and hand watering every day. Drip irrigation is you just flick a valve, water it, turn it on, turn it off. You're out there working anyway. It's not additional labor there. The good thing about a high tunnel is when you're using drip irrigation is that you're watering just the crop and not the between the rows. If you're overhead irrigating, you're watering everything, and that creates a weed problem between the rows. But high tunnel growers are finding that if they don't water the 2-foot path between their tomato rows, is the weeds just aren't going to grow very well there because it's total desert environment.
Now, of course, if they're watering with drip irrigation, the water has to come from somewhere. Does that create water usage problems?
No. The drip irrigation system, if they were growing it out of doors and they had to water anyway, the drip irrigation system uses 50% less water than does a standard overhead irrigation system. And it's more efficient because it's going directly to the roots of the crop and not on the foliage or thrown up in the air so part of it evaporates. It's a very efficient method of watering.
And presumably now, a number of producers are also using rainwater for that.
That's right. I worked with a ag engineer, Sean Schaus, down in southwest Iowa at the Armstrong Research Farm, and we did a prototype project in which we put gutters on the high tunnel, collected the rainwater into 1,000-gallon tanks, and then using solar, pumped that water, using solar to power it, then a marine battery, and pumped that irrigation water into our high tunnel. So we're reusing and recirculating that water rather than have the water just drain right off the edges of the high tunnel. And it is estimated that on a 30-by-96-foot high tunnel, which is the sort of the standard of the industry, one of them, 30-by-96, a half-inch rain will produce 900 gallons of water. So you could collect potentially 900 gallons of water off a half inch of rain. That's a lot.
Yeah. All right, let's get back to the phones. Thomas is on the line next in Iowa City. Hi, Thomas.
Hi. I just had another endorsement for service berries. I was so happy to hear you guys were talking about them. We had blueberries that we put in, and they did just terribly despite, like, amending the soil and everything. And obviously people are always calling into this program asking about their blueberries. And so a lot of people are having to do a lot of work for them. And so this plant, I think, is just great because it takes no amendments to the soil. Mm-hmm. And this is the first year that I had them, that I knew about them. And we picked tons of them, and they are just delicious. They're, like, born in big clusters, so they're easy to pick. And the seeds even have, like, almost a slight taste, like almond essence, which is really great in baked goods and pies and stuff. So I'm just so glad to hear that you guys were talking about them. So that's all.
All right. Thomas, thanks a lot for your call. Let's go next to Jordan in Johnston. Hi, Jordan.
Hello, Charity.
Hi. What's your question today?
Yeah, I have an organic vegetable farm in Johnston, Iowa, and we grow a lot of garlic. And this is the second year in a row we've gotten hit by aster yellow. So I was just curious if you guys could kind of share what you know about aster yellows and if you could offer any hope for the future of saving my own seed.
Boy, that's difficult. Aster yellows is a disease. It occurs on a number of things. Probably most commonly, as far as gardeners are concerned, on purple coneflower.
Okay.
But it can occur on annuals like marigolds, other perennials. And it's a very unique organism. It's what they call a phytoplasma, which is very
correct,
similar to a virus. And it's spread by sap-feeding insects, like leafhoppers. And once the plant has it, it's basically permanent. And so, for example, in the case of purple coneflower, if you notice a plant that is producing very odd-looking flowers, it just must be aster yellows, you basically dig up the plant and destroy it because you can't do anything else. So it's very difficult when you grow something and you have insects and they go from plant to plant. And if you have some plants that have aster yellows, then they can be transmitting it. So it's a very difficult situation, which in the case of garlic would suggest that if you have that problem, that you really can't keep your own, because if you do, you're just propagating it as far as the disease. Mm-hmm. And so
we have a lot of seed that's kind of been held in Iowa for about 15 years, so it's kind of a disheartening thing to try to lose that. But
so,
do you think there's any cure in the future? Or?
I'm not sure. What you might want to do is maybe check with our plant pathologist, Mark Gleason, here at Iowa State, and see if he has any views on that. But that is going to be a big issue because you can't really save the cloves, because if you do, you're actually spreading the disease around potentially. So I would check with Mark Gleason. He is the horticulture crop plant pathologist, and see what he might suggest.
Okay. All right. I appreciate it. Thank you.
All right. Good luck, Jordan. Thanks a lot for calling the show. Let's do an email question here. This is from Carl. He says, this spring I used a weed and feed product on my lawn. My lawn is looking better than ever, but I still have lots of weeds. I wonder if I waited too long to apply it in mid-May.
Well, I would say if you're dealing with broadleaf weeds, this would be things like dandelion, plantain, clover. The actual best time to apply that is in the fall. You get much better control. So you can apply it in the spring. You may get some control, but not nearly as effective as if you do it in the fall. And when I say fall, basically I'm meaning basically late September, October into early November. And basically in the fall of the year, the plants are getting ready for winter. So their foliage is manufacturing food and then sending that food down into the root system. So if you look at a dandelion, which has a very long taproot, they're storing food in that taproot, so you have this downward flow in the plant. So if you apply a broadleaf herbicide in the fall, the plant foliage absorbs that, and then it moves down with the food into the root, killing it. In the spring of the year, when you have this dandelion, the food in the root is going up to the foliage to make the foliage and the flowers. So you have this upward movement. And so when you apply a broadleaf herbicide, you have the upward movement in the plant. The herbicide doesn't move as readily into the actual root. So it's not as effective.
All right. We have this from Beth in Ankeny. We were talking about the Japanese beetles and the fact that it's almost time for them. Beth says, I saw my first Japanese beetle of the summer last night in Ankeny. They're on their way. They're pretty beetles. I just don't like what they do to my plants.
They're not pretty. I'm sorry.
All right. Paul is on the line next from Indianola. Hi, Paul.
Hi. I've got raspberry plants that used to produce like buckets of raspberries, and then one year it just switched and they produced like nothing or hardly anything at all. We've tried planting some new raspberry plants with them, but they tend to get yellow, wilty, and die off. I have no idea what to look for to figure out why the raspberry plants haven't been producing in the last few years.
If they haven't been producing, I would suspect they have some type of disease, possibly a virus. And so my initial thought would be, I'm going to destroy all these plants, dig them all up and destroy them, and then look for an alternate planting site. I don't want to put them back in the same area if I can avoid it.
And how much farther away should the new site be?
Oh, like 25 feet or so. It doesn't have to be that far away, but just a different site because there might be something in the soil that you want to avoid. And so I would do that, and then I would go ahead and buy plants from a reputable garden center. Because if they are, they should be certified disease-free. So new soil, new plants.
All right. I'll give it a try. Thank you.
All right. Thanks for your call, Paul. Let's go next to Marge in Corydon. Hi, Marge.
Hi. I'm calling about some roses that I got started out in my flower bed. I brought it in from the country, not knowing what type it was or anything, and I babied it along, and now you can't stop it. It's just growing like mad. This year, I had a lot of shrubbery, and it was covered with beautiful roses that smelled really good. Do I have multiflora rose?
Well, what color
do
are
they? Smell good?
Well, most
pink.
most roses do.
They're pink.
They're pink?
And what I'm asking, if it isn't multiflora rose, which I should probably, can I cut them back to the ground after they bloom so that I don't get, you know, they're just so tall now. There's 5 feet tall. You know, I don't want them to get any bigger.
Okay. Multiflora rose typically, I think, has a whitish flower on it.
Well, this is pink.
Rather than pink.
And they were pretty, and they bloomed all over.
And the other thing they have is, on the multiflora rose, they have these thorns, and they're hooked. They're not a straight, they're more of a hooked thorn.
I haven't noticed
that. And so you might want to check that, too. So most have a fairly straight thorn, but they have more of a hooked thorn.
Yeah, so, no, these, I think, are just straight.
Okay.
But they are thorny.
Okay.
And they do, I have noticed since I was weeding out there early in the spring, two or three times, and I found that they travel by their roots. Hmm. And so I pulled some of them up by their roots and cut them off with a clipper and tried to keep them under control. I don't want them to take over the whole yard.
Okay. Well, you can definitely prune them back if you wish to.
I cut them clear down to the ground, or would you leave them?
I don't think I would do that. I would leave some of it. You say they're 5 feet tall?
Yeah, they about are, yeah.
Okay. I could see where you could prune those back to maybe 2-2.5 feet.
Okay.
You can definitely take some off at the ground, especially if they're spreading. And
yeah,
you
they
want
are.
To, if you want to control the size of the clump,
yeah.
I would cut off those at the edge right off at the ground. And maybe leave the center plants pretty much intact.
Okay.
All right. Marge, good luck with that.
Thank you.
Thanks a
lot
for your call.
Thank you very much. Bye.
Bye. Next up, we'll go to Jeff on the line in Des Moines. Hi, Jeff.
Well, hello. I've been battling mold. mulberry trees in my lot in Des Moines. And are there two sexes? I mean, is it male and female, like jojoba bushes?
Well, mulberries are kind of unique in that some plants are strictly male, some plants are strictly female, and then some have both male and female flowers on them. So they're kind
okay.
of, they
I've
vary.
I've got one tree that it just
yeah.
has multiple, like, blackberry-looking
mm-hmm.
things, and they're just wading down the whole tree.
Mm-hmm.
That must be a female tree.
Mm-hmm. Apparently it's predominantly female, yes.
Okay, and basically, another question as far as broadleaf herbicide. What is spurge?
Oh,
the weed?
Yeah. Spurge is a broadleaf weed. If you pinch a stem, milky sap forms at the end of that pinch.
Yeah.
And it's very, very hard to control.
Yeah.
It's one of the more difficult ones. I would say the best way to get rid of spurge, because some of these are annual plants,
yeah.
annual weeds, the best way to get rid of it is to develop a nice, thick lawn
yeah.
where you have very few opportunities for weeds to grow. So that
yeah.
means cutting it properly, mowing it properly, maybe fertilizing it, that type of thing, so you have a really nice, thick lawn. And if you don't have a thick lawn, you may want to overseed possibly in late summer. But that's the key, is getting a nice, thick lawn where the spurge simply can't grow.
All right, Jeff, thanks a lot for your call. And let's try to squeeze one more question in. This is Mike. Hi, Mike. Mike, are you there?
This is Mike. Hi.
Yep.
I have a question. You talked me into trying to grow some cherry trees. My soil is very clay, a lot of clay. If I were to plant a cherry tree, say, on a slight slope with a clay soil, would that be well-drained soil?
Well, one thing you can do in a clay soil is make sure you don't plant too deeply, okay? And that means, let's say you buy a plant in a container, and typically you would. I would measure the height of the soil ball in that container and then dig a hole as far as the depth that is two-thirds the height of that soil ball. So it's kind of resting a little bit high, and that's what I would do. So make sure you don't plant too deeply, but also dig a hole that's quite wide, much wider than you need, because that will allow the water to move through the soil much better over a larger area. So that would be my thought.
Okay, great. Thanks very much.
All right, Mike, thanks a lot for your call. And this last email from Barb, my bearded irises have some kind of blight in them. They bloomed great, but now the leaves are rotting and stinky. I'm clearing out the dead rotting leaves and tubers. Is there anything else I should be doing to save them? I hear you can wash the tubers with bleach. What do you think?
I wonder if that might be the iris borer. That's kind of my thought, possibly it is.
Mm-hmm.
What happens is the insect basically starts to feed in the foliage, then works its way down to the rhizome and actually eats most of the rhizome itself. And then once that happens, then you have a bacterial soft rot attack the damaged rhizome, and it gives off this very unpleasant odor, very bad odor. It smells bad.
Okay.
So in that situation, I would be inclined to dig them all up, inspect each one, and replant the good ones, those that have a good, solid rhizome, toss everything else.
All right, and she can plant them in the same spot?
Yep. Well, yeah, she can.
All right, Richard Geron, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Richard Geron, Iowa State University Extension horticulturist. Linda Nave, thank you.
Thank you.
Iowa State University Extension program specialist with the value-added agriculture program. Talk of Iowa is produced by Dennis Reese, Emily Woodbury, Sarah Bowden, and Ben Stanton. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. Technical support today from Jason Burns and Julie Englander. I'm Charity Nebbe. On Monday, we continue our series looking at Iowa's prison system. This is Talk of Iowa.